This is a podcast from the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge.
My name is Jim Secord, and I'm director of the Charles Darwin Correspondence Project and professor of history and philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge. Darwin's entire vision of science was really shaped by his early experience of geology. He first became fascinated by the subject, in fact, as a young boy when he was collecting pebbles along the coast of Wales and other places that his family visited during holidays. But it was really when he went up to Edinburgh and he heard a series of lectures in the University of Edinburgh while he was studying to become a medical student that really convinced him that in many ways there was lots going on in geology, that it was a very exciting science. Geology, in fact, was new at the time that Darwin was first studying it. It was a subject which had really come into being in the early 19th century as a way of understanding the Earth, both in terms of how the Earth had been formed, but also in terms of the structure of the Earth and looking at it as a whole, how it had come into being and ultimately perhaps where it was going. When Darwin went to Cambridge, he attended more geological lectures, and in fact, after he had his degree, he began thinking about going on a geological field trip to Tenerife. And he was very excited about this, got some of his friends together. So he even went on a field trip up in North Wales with his professor of geology at Cambridge, Adam Sedgwick, to learn the techniques of geological field surveying. So from the very beginning, in many ways, Darwin's main orientation was to think of himself as somebody who had this strong interest in the Earth. But I think it's fair to say that what really set him on his course, where he identified himself as he put it in one of his notebooks, I, a geologist, was the Beagle Voyage itself. He set off on the trip with the first volume of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, and as he said later in his autobiography, it was the very first place he landed on the trip that convinced him of the superiority of Lyell's way of dealing with things than any other method of geology that he had ever seen. For Darwin, geology was an exciting science because it allowed him to combine close observation, the tiny differences between rocks and the different ways they had been formed, the different ways that you could identify them, with huge processes that might affect the entire Earth. So the first place he lands, in the middle of the Atlantic, in the Canary Islands, in fact, he picks up stones and realizes that actually he's looking at an ancient volcanic series of rocks, and he can understand how they've been formed. He can actually, in fact, make original discoveries about these rocks. And he later remembers in his autobiography the wonderful experience he has on a hot desert beach, thinking of the fact that he could write a geological book and he could be a geologist. One of the things I think that convinced him that Lyell's system was so, as he put it, infinitely superior to any other way of dealing with things was that it allowed him to think about how tiny processes of the sort that he could see in action around him could add up to really big processes in Earth history. In 1830, Lyell published the first volume of his Principles of Geology, the book that Darwin had with him on the Beagle Voyage. And for Darwin, this was a wonderful way of thinking about how to tackle problems in geology as he saw them on the voyage. Lyell wanted to show that all the small processes that we saw around us could add up to these big processes, and that you didn't need sudden catastrophes, you didn't need huge floods or anything like that to explain how these Earth phenomena came into being. But Lyell also, in some sense, provided a catalog of geological spectaculars. He showed you that the Earth was much more active than anybody had thought, that what you could observe on a trip, in fact, like the one that Darwin was on, was stupendous processes of earthquakes and volcanoes and great geological change. And it was this combination of putting together these processes and showing how over the course of Earth history that you could explain all the phenomena through causes which were like those that we saw around us with our own eyes that led Darwin really to think that, you know, he could start to use this kind of way that Lyell saw things to explain not just the Earth, but other sorts of things around us. We could start to use things that we actually saw with our eyes, processes in action, to explain the phenomena of nature. So in the end, geology for Darwin was a form of visual education. It was seeing something in those details, just like he had seen all those details of insects and other kinds of creatures in his other studies at Cambridge. But now he could understand how those could lead to huge processes that created the world as we see it, new continents, new oceans, and indeed, ultimately, new species. One of the most striking pictures, at least to my mind, in the exhibition is Robert Farron's large painting of Duryea Antiqua. This is very interesting, I think. It was based originally on a small lithograph, which was widely distributed among geologists in the 1830s. The original design for it had been done by a man named Henri de Labèche, who was trained in military drawing and was one of the most accomplished artists in the geologists of his generation. What Ferrand did was take this small illustration and make it into a large-scale painting. Now, this painting would have been seen by many, many students of Adam Sedgwick. It would have been seen later on in Sedgwick's life when he had it at his rooms in Norwich, where he was actually a canon of the church. Sedgwick was professor of geology at Cambridge, and this image, which has its origins in the early 1830s, is very much the public image of geology for 1830. Duryea Antiquer is an attempt to show all the new exciting discoveries of geology in one visual glance. You see everything together. And this really is nature in tooth and claw. Everything is eating everything else. The huge, you can see there's a huge plesiosaur, which is then being eaten in turn by an ichthyosaur. There are animals and various fish and other kinds of invertebrate animals that are actually swimming around. It's a very exciting and lively kind of place. In 1830s terms, this image is very much the equivalent for us of Jurassic Park, the kind of thing that people would have just flocked to see. And the reason, I think, is quite clear. These creatures were new. These are the known ancient reptiles of the past. They aren't, in fact, dinosaurs. It's a different category of creature. But they have the same attractions that dinosaurs have for us. They're large, they're fierce, they're scary, and they're effectively completely different than anything that we would know. Just imagine if you were a young child in 1830 and you looked at this thing and you thought, you know, scientists have discovered this thing. I can, you know, there's all these, the ground we walk on, you know, this is ancient Dorset. You know, quiet Dorset with its little villages. And in fact, it was this scene of carnage and destruction. And this kind of idea of opening up this new visual world was incredibly exciting for people in the 1830s. Now, this particular painting probably was mainly, as I've said, seen mainly by students and by people who knew Adam Sedgwick. But in fact, images like this, in fact, potentially even identical to this, were on show in London in the 1830s and 40s, at some of the main London tourist sites. These were places like the Colosseum, where you could see huge panoramic versions of ancient life. You could go down in the basement there and see changing, shifting scenes, almost like slideshows, really, that showed the incredible changes of life over history. And this kind of vision, that the Earth, in fact, hadn't been created just in a short period of time, but had a very long history and a very different kind of history, was one that just excited people tremendously during the 1830s. So when we see a picture like Duryea Antiquer, we're having some of that same sort of experience that people would have had in the time that Darwin was just leaving on the Beagle voyage. The Victorians found geology incredibly exciting and enlivening science. It offered them opportunities for exploration. It offered opportunities for thinking about the exploration of the world, and it involved opportunities for thinking about the deep past. But for many of them, there were disquieting aspects to this as well. As John Ruskin said, he could hear the hammers at the end of every Bible verse. And there was a way that some of the discoveries, particularly those involving where humans had come from and what the purpose of the Earth had been during those long ages when there were no human beings, raised questions about why were we here? What was our purpose? Were humans special? So geology, in that sense, was very much a double-edged science. It was a science that at one level offered the attractions of escaping into past worlds, of exploring nature, but at the same time, it offered a sense of human insignificance. And we can see this very clearly in William Dyce's wonderful painting, Pegwell Bay. Here at one level, we can see people out on the shore, and if you imagine it from their perspective, they're having the fascination of collecting sea animals, shells, other objects of natural history. They're actually examining the strata. Some of them are probably, you know, interested in geology. Some of them might be quite serious geologists. But then at the same time, there's an overwhelming sense in the painting of brooding insignificance. There's a way in which the figures are crushed down by the great chalk cliffs in the distance. There's a way in which the setting sun and the relatively somber colors of the painting give an idea that, in some sense, this is the twilight of the human race, that things are going to come to an end, that the tide is going to in some sense, continue to go out, and the humans will just be abandoned there. And finally, there's, of course, a sense of cosmic insignificance, because in the high sky above, you can see the great comet, Donati's comet, which was widely observed throughout Britain in 1857. This gives a sense that these great events are going on, and in fact, the people aren't even paying attention to that. They're actually looking at something else. There's a sort of way in which there's a disconnect between the grandeur and the power and the forces of nature that have been so exciting in many of the paintings that the exhibition has. But in this case, it seems to indicate that humans, in the end, don't really matter very much. One point also, I think, to emphasize about this painting is that it's a very specific moment in time. The painting is subtitled A Recollection of October 5th, 1858. This ties it very closely into the idea that, you know, here we have a moment, it's not even just a day, it's actually a specific moment in the evening. And yet there's a sort of sense in which this day extends outwards from that, both into the very deep past of time, and with the idea of the comet and the other things, to the idea of a continuing recursive aspect of nature. So that people in some sense are just caught up in this vast continuum of dates, of which that specific date, that October 5th, is just one tiny moment in time in which people are located. It relates in many ways to the sort of pictures that people were used to seeing in places like the Illustrated London News. It ties their own life into a broader sense. In that case, it would have been of human history, but then it also ties it into broader kinds of concentric circles of time in which geology really was creating a sense of what ultimately was the purpose of life. A final point to note about this painting is that it's before Darwin. I think we often assume that the combination of exhilaration about science and that combination of doubt is something that comes after Darwin, and Darwin is responsible for that. But here we see what I think is probably the most powerful artistic expression in British art of precisely that feeling, and this is a year before Darwin. This is a feeling that Darwin's work encapsulated. It's a work that, in many ways, people could use Darwin's book to think about. But in some sense, the ideas are already there. The controversy and the difficulties are already there. And without that kind of pre-existing sort of matrix for Darwin's works to fit into and to be read, The Origin of Species would have fallen upon an unreceptive audience. People wouldn't have made so much out of it. So it's in some ways precisely the fact that Darwin's work encapsulates and captures so much of what's going on in a painting like Pegwell Bay, or in many of these geological landscapes that we've seen, many of which, in fact, most of which predate Darwin, that Darwin's prose is able to achieve the kind of power and the kind of influence that it eventually gains.